Our next speaker is Marketa McGuire Elsner. She's research scientist with the Climate Impacts Group here at the University of Washington.
Okay, great. I'm wearing two microphones here, so I also feel like an experiment right now. I'm happy to be here this morning. My name again is Marketa McGuire Elsner, and I'm working with the Climate Impacts Group and here today to talk about a project that's currently underway studying and evaluating the impacts of climate change on the state of Washington. This is very much an interdisciplinary project involving a number of departments here at the university, as well as Washington State University and Pacific Northwest National Labs. Edward Miles and Dennis Lettenmeyer are the principal investigators for this study, and Jeremy Littell and myself, as well as working on components of this study, we're also helping to coordinate the day-to-day activities. Now, this climate impacts assessment is a coordinated effort between the Climate Impacts Group, as I said, the Washington State Department of Ecology, and the State Department of Community, Trade, and Economic Development, or CTED. And the project was funded through legislation signed by the governor last spring. So we've been underway since about the summertime, 2007. And we're looking at the impacts of climate change on a number of different sectors, some of which SIG has been involved with in the past, such as water resources, energy, salmon, forest resources. But this is really an opportunity to expand into areas that SIG has not been involved with in the past, and where we really know very little about the impacts of climate change. And those include infrastructure, civil infrastructure with particular emphasis on stormwater facilities and systems, human health, agriculture and irrigated agriculture, and the economics associated with that, and coastal resources. I should mention, too, that an additional part of this is looking at adaptation and trying to identify some of the barriers, both legal and institutional, to adapting to climate change. Now, some of the goals of this impact assessment, the main goal is to evaluate the impacts of climate change into the next century, with particular focus on the next 50 years. We'll be using climate scenarios from the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, which was released last spring. We'll be showing regional impacts and hoping to identify areas of high and low sensitivity to climate change. As I mentioned before, trying to characterize some of the barriers to adaptation. Hoping to provide tools for policymakers and other stakeholder groups that can then utilize this information for their own planning purposes and incorporating climate change. And we're also collaborating with the governor's climate change challenge, which I'll describe a little bit in a minute. As I said, this project got underway last summer. We produced an interim report at the end of December, and final analyses will be completed by the end of this year. Now, the governor issued an executive order last spring for the Washington Climate Change Challenge, and there are really two goals for this. One, to look at current and future ways to reduce or mitigate greenhouse gas emissions and CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. And the second is to help to identify some or come up with some recommendations on how we can best prepare and adapt to this change that we know is happening and will continue to happen. And these recommendations are currently in draft form and are being finalized as we speak. Now, this climate change challenge formed a climate advisory team, and there are really two groups working within this. There's a set of technical working groups that are looking at the mitigation side of reducing CO2 emissions. And then there's this other set of groups, which are the preparedness or preparation and adaptation working groups. And there are a number of those that roughly parallel the sectors for this climate change assessment that we're doing here at SIG. Now, this shows the rough parallel between these adaptation working groups, or so-called POGs, and the sectors that we're working with in our group here. And many of the members of our team are serving in these adaptation working groups or have served in these adaptation working groups, helping to provide some technical guidance and information on the latest science in terms of what we understand climate change to be. I thought I would explain a little bit the framework that we're working within, incorporating climate information and trying to also incorporate the uncertainty in the predictions that we make. And we'll be doing this by using 20 global climate models or climate scenarios from 20 GCMs that are part of this 2007 IPCC report, and looking at two emission scenarios, which are generally different projections of what greenhouse gas concentrations will be. And then looking at two approaches at downscaling, or essentially mapping the information at the global climate model level down to a finer resolution hydrology modeling level. One of those approaches is a statistical downscaling approach, and the other is a more dynamical approach that incorporates also some regional climate modeling. We're utilizing two hydrology models for different areas of Washington State. The first is the DHSVM model. The second is the Variable Infiltration Capacity Model, or VIC. And both of these models, as you may know, have been developed at the University of Washington here. And so each of these projected futures or climate scenarios that we'll get from these global climate models and emission scenarios will be input into these hydrology models to essentially produce a suite of predictions of various hydrologic parameters like stream flow, soil moisture, potential evapotranspiration, vapor pressure deficit, things of that sort. And I thought I'd go through some of the preliminary findings that went into our interim report in December. And this is a picture of projected temperatures into the 2020s, 2040s, and 2080s, looking at those two emission scenarios I mentioned, the B1 and the A1B. The red sort of bar that you see there is the A1B scenario, and that represents sort of a more aggressive and, I guess, shows less conservation in terms of CO2 emissions. The red line there being the sort of weighted average of what the global climate models predict. And the yellow bar there shows the B1 scenario, which is a more, I guess, a greener emissions scenario. And the purpose of showing these two scenarios is really just to show a range of possible futures. And you'll notice that up to about the 2020s or 2030s, these two scenarios follow quite closely with each other. So we expect and have a good amount of confidence in the projections out to 2030 of about a little more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit in terms of increase in temperature. And this is over the Pacific Northwest. And I should mention that these changes are relative to an average from 1970 to 1999, which is considered current climate. And then out into the 2040s or so, we can expect temperatures increasing of about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and then out later in the century, 2080s or so, upwards of 6 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, I'm not showing a similar picture here of precipitation, mainly because the picture is a lot messier than this. We have a lot less confidence in our predictions of precipitation, mainly due to the high amount of variability in historic precipitation that we've seen. In general, the global climate models suggest slight increases in precipitation in the Pacific Northwest, with particularly higher increases in the wintertime and even decreases of precipitation in the summertime. But again, when you look at the historic variability, it's really difficult to say whether that's significant. This is looking at some of the impacts on hydrology and water resources. This is a picture of April 1st snow water equivalent, and snow water equivalent is generally the water content in the snowpack. And this picture shows the two scenarios, the A1B and the B1, as rows. And the first column there shows the historic snowpack on April 1st averaged, essentially the same picture. And then projections into the 2040s, or 2020s and 2040s. And essentially what this is showing is you know, some of what we've been hearing in the past, we have seen decreases in snowpack historically, and you know, and we project that that will continue, and out to the 2040s, we can expect anywhere from 35 up to 41 or so percent of a decrease in terms of April 1st snowpack. Now looking at coastal resources, the SIG actually just published a sort of a white paper on sea level rise and our understanding of sea level rise, which I encourage you to look at. But generally, as sea level rises, we can expect increased flooding, erosion, and habitat loss over much of our coastline. And in the 2050s, at least in our Puget Sound area, we might expect an average of 6 inches of sea level rise, with the variability or error bars shown there in the column. And out toward 2100, we can expect a foot or possibly more of sea level rise. And due to the uncertainty in these projections, we really can't rule out, you know, much higher increases up to 4 feet or so. And in terms of agriculture, water supplies for irrigation, of course, are likely to decline as snowpack changes and decreases. Greater stressing our water supplies that are already being stressed now. In terms of dry land agriculture, what we might expect with climate change or longer growing season, some reduced summer precipitation, as I mentioned, and increased competition with weeds. And diseases may become more problematic over time. In terms of salmon resources, many of our rivers and streams are already seeing summer temperatures exceed water quality criteria, and into the 2040s, we can expect that only to increase with increased air temperatures, and we anticipate upwards of 50%, or with our analyses, 50% of the stations that we looked at that are recording water temperature show exceedances of water quality criteria. Now in terms of forest resources, wildfires, as we understand, are strongly associated with climate, particularly on the east side forests. And mountain pine beetle has and will continue to pose a significant threat to these forests as they become more stressed with reduced water supplies, reduced soil moistures, higher temperatures. And of course, tree species composition is likely to change, and productivity of some types of forests are also likely to decrease. In terms of infrastructure, now we're mainly looking at stormwater facilities, and we know that stormwater impacts and management already carry high costs are associated with them, and with these increases in precipitation, increased flooding events, we can only anticipate that those costs are going to go up. In terms of energy, we'll still be heating our homes during the wintertime, and that'll dominate the energy that we use, but of course during the summertime, as temperatures increase, we'll be relying on energy to cool our homes and that sort of thing. And this picture shows projections into the 2020s and 2040s for the A1B, or the more aggressive emission scenario, showing the increase of cooling degree days over the interior of Columbia. And in terms of human health, of course, summer, as temperatures rise, we're going to see more heat waves. These warmer temperatures are going to affect air quality and the level of particulates in the air. Increased temperatures and flooding may alter habitats of vector-borne diseases. Much of this we're only learning about now. Very little research has been done in the past on these sorts of things. And the most vulnerable populations, of course, are going to be young children, elderly, and those folks that really are going to have the hardest time adapting. And that's all I have, but I wanted to mention that this interim report that I was presenting the results from is on the web. If you just go to the Climate Impacts Group website, you can navigate to that and take a closer look and learn the details. Thank you. And I'd be happy to take any questions you have at this point. Sure, go ahead.
Earlier in your talk, you spoke about the predicted possible increase in sea level in Puget Sound, 2100 of 12 inches and 2040 of 6 inches, but that you couldn't rule out the possibility of increases as high as 4 feet because of level of certainty. What level of certainty are you associating with those predictions?
Actually, sure. Laura, I'm going to defer this to Laura Whiteley-Binder. She actually helped put this report together and could maybe speak a little bit more to that.
Is this on? Okay, great. What you were seeing there is the range of projections, and the higher estimates of sea level rise, the potential for 4 feet, comes from almost a worst-case scenario set of assumptions. So you're assuming that Greenland and Antarctica continue to melt at accelerated rates that have been observed over the last 4 years or so. And that melting trend, accelerated melting trend, continues through the end of the century. It assumes that regionally that rates of subsidence are at the upper bounds of what we estimate those rates to be currently be for the Puget Sound region. And then it also assumes that there's a change in coastal winds that continually push more coastal waters up against the coast, which can lead to increases in sea level. So it's taking the kind of the worst case scenario for each of those factors and compiling those numbers together, and that's where you get the 50 inches of sea level rise that is possible for the Puget Sound. It's considered a very low probability. Now, there isn't an actual percentage of confidence assigned to that, but it's considered a very low probability, but still something that is possible. We can't exclude it from the range of possibilities. So that those high estimates as well as lower estimates are provided so that people can gauge their planning needs based on their risk tolerance. For some people, they may want to take 50 inches into an account. In other cases, the medium estimate of about 13 inches is adequate for their planning needs.
How about over there?
One of the things that you said was that Douglas fir forest productivity is projected to decline, and I just wondered why what's the reason for that?
Mainly due to the
question.
Oh, I'm sorry. the question was regarding forests and Douglas fir and what the reasoning is behind the decrease in productivity of Douglas fir. Of Douglas fir forests. And I would say that at least, you know, I personally am not a forester, but what I've heard, and maybe someone can elaborate further on, is that much of the growth in productivity, or much of the growth, I should say, comes in the younger trees. And if we see increased stresses on our climate system, those younger trees are going to have a harder time surviving. We maybe don't have, aren't worried so much on the larger trees because, you know, they've been around for 100 years or more and can withstand certain changes in climate. Maybe they don't grow as much, but they don't just die necessarily. So I think really it was focused on these younger trees. Somebody in the back there with a blue shirt.
I didn't see any category of ecosystems and species extinctions. Are you looking at those separately, like the species associated with coasts or with forests or with water, or how do those get taken into account?
Oh, you know, wildlife is not something that we're really... Not that it certainly shouldn't be looked at, it absolutely should. But our work is really focusing on impacts on salmon, forests, so not wildlife per se or specific species. We may speak to changes in certain types of species, I guess, related to other things. That probably doesn't answer your question very well, but how about right up here?
I can answer the forest question if you want.
Okay.
So an answer to the forest productivity question,
The fact that snowpack decreases means that the actual length of the, quote, growing season increases. And if summer precipitation decreases and temperatures rise, then really the period that plants, trees depend upon water will decrease. And that is directly reflected in the amount of productivity or the productivity potential of any forest.
Thank you. Do we have time for another one? Sure.
In terms of adaptation to climate changes in the future, especially in terms of economic adaptation, I wonder, you talked about for one particular section for ag, you talked about some of the negative changes. I wonder if you saw any or if you predicted any opportunities for different agricultural products or...
Sure. Sure, there certainly will be some of that. One area that I know has been spoken about is the wine or grape industry. You know, the conditions in California are going to, you know, potentially become worse as things dry out even more. But, you know, Washington is going to see, longer growing season, more favorable climate conditions for grapes. So that's certainly one area that will see increased or economic benefits. Oh.
Can you just say something about what the projected population demographics are in conjunction with the kind of...
Yeah, so what we're going to be using population projections coming from the Office of Financial Management, OFM, from the state. And they predict out generally out to 2030 or so, I think, right now. They're actually quite hesitant to project populations much beyond that. So we'll, you know, be focusing our effort here on the near term and have to do some extrapolations on population. And I think that'll really come into play when looking at impacts on human health.
What might be done in the way of, what is Central Puget Sound doing in the way of repairing and restoration and perhaps changes in dam operation that might help combat global warming impacts?
That's a big question. I guess there are probably many answers to that depending on what you're looking at. I'm not sure what I would respond to specifically in terms of impacts.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have seen a tremendous response from the water resource managers for this information, and they take this information. They are looking at how they may need to adjust reservoir operations to compensate for higher stream flow temperatures and impacts to salmon, for example. The reality is that at least those systems where there are dams, there are at least going to be levers that you can use to help offset increasing stream flow temperatures as compared to the unregulated streams where the impacts may be more severe just because there isn't a way to compensate easily for those higher water temperatures. But how operations will change in the Puget Sound region as well as the Columbia River system is still to be seen, but certainly changes are expected.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Marquette.